Hey, everybody. Welcome to the CLG podcast, where we break down the information asymmetry on all things blockchains, oracles, and smart contracts. So I've been running this podcast for a couple of years now with a pretty admittedly inconsistent cadence, but we've covered a wide range of topics within the crypto industry, from talking to various projects in Web3 to talking about the horrific industry events that seemingly keep happening. On this episode with the Crypto Oracle and I want to take things back to its roots a little bit and talk about Chainlink. But this won't be a regular episode about Chainlink. Rather, we have the one and only Chainlink co-founder himself, Sergey Nazarov, on to answer some common community questions that come up from time to time and get his insights on what it's been like developing Chainlink and his perspective on the community itself. So to kick things off, welcome, Sergey. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Great to be here. CLG, great to talk with you on the podcast. Excited to provide some insight into why things are happening the way they are. I think I don't spend a huge amount of time on social media because I don't know if that's what people really want from me. I think what's more important is that I and a number of other great people in our community are focused on building Chainlink into the global standard for cryptographic truth. So I'm glad we can have this talk, and I can help clarify for folks some of the things that seem to be open questions. And I'll do my best to do that to the degree that, you know, I'm able to do that. But yeah, like I said, it's not always my priority, and I'm glad we're doing this so I can clarify some things.
Absolutely. I appreciate you coming on and answering some of these community questions. Before we get into the meat of the discussion, I want to start with some rapid fire questions. So firstly, what is your favorite Chainlink meme out of them all?
I've seen a lot of memes, and they're really, really creative. And I don't have a lot of expertise in making these things myself. And I really appreciate the thoughtfulness and creativity that goes into them. I think my favorite one, and I don't know what this is going to do, so I don't know what's going to be the result of this point. I don't know if this is going to create more of them or less of them or what, but it was the one where I actually understood that something pretty unique was going on with our community and the project and so on. It was the one where I'm fighting a bear. So the one where there's like a bear and I'm fighting it in a ripped shirt, that was the first meme that I looked at it and I was like, I'm not sure what's going on here, but clearly these folks are pretty excited. And I'm excited. And you know, I looked at it and I'm like, that's really interesting. And I was like, that's great. I'm going to get back to work. But the reason I like it also is because I like to go camping, and I've actually been camping, and I've lived in the woods for entire days, days at a time. I find that it really clears my mind. And I've actually encountered real bears, and I've been maybe 5 or 6 feet from a bear, from a black bear, and then it ran away. But it's actually just funny to me because you would never want to do that with a bear. You would never do it. When you encounter a bear, it's very, you know, the adrenaline kicks in, fight or flight, reminds you about the value of life, that type of stuff. So I thought it was just funny that people had an idea that I could fight a bear in a hand fist fight and could survive that. That was kind of like pretty unique. And you know, that's why it's my favorite one, both because it's the first one I really paid a lot of attention to, and because the idea of fighting a bear is a kind of, you know, extreme fascinating thing, which I would never ever actually do. But yeah, that's why.
That's funny. It's memetic energy becoming a reality. We just want to clarify. So you've never made a meme.
I'm not sure what the definition of a meme is. I'm not clear on what the formal definition is. If the idea of a meme is that you can make a statement, you can write down words, then maybe. If a meme has to be visual, then no, I don't think I've ever made a meme. The reason I've resisted making memes is because I have a feeling they'd be relatively dark. I think there's a big difference between being pessimistic and being cynical. I think they'd be cynical, but they'd be viewed as pessimistic. And so I'm worried that that if I make visual memes, they'll be viewed, they'll have a very dark comedic bent to them that won't do me any favors. I just stick to the written word and some quotes I know from other people and try to share some of my thoughts. So if the written word can count as a meme, then maybe.
Interesting. So another important question that the communities, I think, wondered. So how did you come to settle on the blue flannel? And do you ever get the desire to just change it up, wear something different?
I'm a fan of simplicity. And I'm a fan of conserving energy for the things that really, really matter. The way I settled on the blue flannel was that I think it was relatively cheap and on sale in some store in San Francisco. And I've always liked flannel type stuff because people that go camping and people that, I don't know, it's just the thing. It's, you know, there's a lot of flannel shirts that that you could get that are good for the outdoors, that type of stuff, you know? So I just chose it. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it, frankly. And then it took on a kind of life of its own. And I had no issue with that. That's totally fine. In fact, it's people's interest in my blue flannel shirt that makes the blue flannel shirt the most valuable thing I could wear, right? Because there's no other pattern of clothing that I could wear that would somehow have more value. And I really just don't care. I really just, it doesn't matter to me what I wear. It's not something I want to spend time thinking about. I've worn the same pair of shoes for many years, so I don't have to choose shoes. I wear the same style of pants. It's not a good use of my time to think about what I'm going to wear. I definitely don't want to think about it in the morning when I think about certain key issues. I've noticed that a lot of people have very good creative thoughts in the morning, both writers and you know, people that build technology and a number of other folks throughout history. And I think what happened is I realized one day that I really don't want to give away my time in the morning to thinking about clothing. It's valuable time where I can have creative thoughts. And I have no desire to change it up. It doesn't matter to me. It only matters to me as far as it helps attain my goals and it doesn't distract me. And I'm glad people like it. And I hope they, you know, I'm always glad to help if I can, basically.
Yeah, you mentioned you never created a meme, but I think you inadvertently created a meme through the flannel itself, a visual medium for yourself, like a brand identity. But I have another important question. Do you actually like Big Macs?
No. I think that Big Macs are a side effect of me not being at, you know, the best weight of my life and people associating me being slightly overweight with consuming many Big Macs, which is completely untrue. I don't consume Big Macs. The first time I ate a Big Mac for many, many years was actually at SmartCon. I actually don't think I have any metabolic issues or anything that would really contribute to my maybe 10 to 30 pounds beyond what I should be. But it definitely doesn't have to do with Big Macs. It has to do with how I work. And so I basically work many, many hours. And I try to meditate sometimes. That doesn't always work as well as I'd like. And then I also, if I get a chance, I play video games. Because video games get me into kind of a flow state where I can forget about my problems and think more clearly when I come back to them. So disconnect from a variety of difficult and complicated questions to view them with a fresh set of eyes. That would be more accurate than Big Macs. And I also don't know what that's going to result in with the meme dynamic, but we'll see. Maybe nothing. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the Big Mac is kind of a part of your brand now. Even if it's true or not, it's just kind of how memes flow as they're efficient. I do want to step into your background a little bit more. You've been in the blockchain industry for a long time, much longer than many other people. What would you say has been the most surprising during your blockchain journey? And specifically, what's changed about building Chainlink ever since the initial white paper was published in 2017?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been in the blockchain industry one way or another since about 2010. And then I started really, really building things a few years after that in a more advanced way. Because when I joined the industry, all you could really do was go to Bitcoin meetups and deal with Bitcoin things. That's all you could do. That's all that there was Bitcoin, right? So there wasn't as much capacity to build on that. It was mainly viewed as like an alternative digital payment system or digital currency or something like that. Microtransactions. When the Bitcoin price is low, microtransactions. That's what it's all about. Bitcoin price is high. Store of value. Here we come. So I started in the microtrans and like, hey, it's a payment system. Some people were already talking about deflationary stuff and store of value, but I don't think it was the dominant idea. I think the dominant idea was an efficient, censorship resistant, non-governmentally controlled payment and monetary system. But there was only that, right? So what I've just been surprised about, I think as many people that get enamored by an idea, is how long this is taking. I've just been continually surprised about how long it's taking for decentralized infrastructure, for consensus computing, for blockchain smart contracts to become the way the world works. And I think that's connected to two things. It's connected to my excitement about what that would mean, and therefore the value of what that would mean. And that would, in my mind, mean that people gain real control over their economic life. And that, if you really think about it, is really important, because if you think about a person's life, you can divide it between like their social media life and their personal life and their health and other things, right? But people's economic life, right? Like their economic dynamic with their bank account and how much money is in there and how much they pay for things and what their wages are and whether or not, you know, something can fail them economically, like whether that's an inflation-related failure or in a bank account failure or something else. Like people spend a lot of their life on economics, right? They spend a lot of their life working, accruing value, investing the value, getting a return on the value in a bank account, buying a home. You know, like people spend a lot of time on this stuff. And, you know, if you read... if you read a lot of literature about politics and economics and political economy and that type of stuff, and a lot of people that are libertarian have read that stuff, and they kind of go in this direction where they become a little bit unhappy with how the current system and how the current world is structured, and then you realize there's this technological alternative to that that will give people real economic control. Could eliminate the speculatively driven booms and busts that, you know, make some people rich while ruining other people's lives, and which allow everyone in the world to be on an equal footing from the point of view of a contractual system that has nothing to do with governmental bias, priorities, or corruption. I mean, that's pretty exciting. And it's pretty obvious. And I think when you get enamored with an idea that you think is obvious, you're kind of always surprised as to why other people do not view it as obvious. And then you are surprised as to why it takes so long for it to become more obvious, more adopted, more implemented. when I got into this industry, I thought Bitcoin would work as a microtransaction payment system, and we'd be buying coffee with Bitcoin. Everyone was thinking that. Everyone was, yeah, I'd buy a coffee with Bitcoin. I'm sad that we didn't go towards that. There's a number of reasons for that. But and it's fine what Bitcoin is now. I'm a big fan of Bitcoin, and I'm glad we're, you know, where it is as this kind of censorship resistant store of value and so on. But that's an example, right? And that's that type of dynamic is something I've recurringly experienced with everything from Bitcoin to the first what were then called app coins when they started, or alternative coins, altcoins. You know, a lot of those promises didn't get fulfilled the way I had hoped. Then smart contracts actually appeared, and then they were limited, right? They were limited to tokenization. And in many ways, our industry is still seen as a tokenization machine. And DeFi has put a dent in that, and a few other things have put a dent in that, but they have not changed that, right? People still see our industry for the large part as a tokenization machine, where people can go and flip some token about some piece of art or something else. And I actually don't have a problem with that. I really don't. I guess the thing that is surprising to me about the industry is why the hell is it taking so long? It's so obvious. It's so much better. It's so much better for everybody. It's better for the consumer. It's better for the institution servicing the consumer. It's better for society. It's better for governmental entities. It's better for everybody. It's like there's like no loss to be had in this deal here to go from this controlled system to this. And so what I decided a while ago was that I'm going to be part of that solution to make it go faster. So I would like me and my work to be part of making it get adopted faster. But it's always a surprise. I'm positive that this year I'll be surprised, next year I'll be surprised, but it's gradually going in the right direction. And as I've met more people that build companies and build technologies, I've noticed a similar thing with them where they're in love with their technology. They're in love with the idea that they're working on. And they have this bias where it's so obvious to them, and they're not always as predictive as they'd like to be on how obvious it'll become to others. But I think it will be. I think it's very clear now that there's no way you're going back to a world where people don't think cryptocurrency is the future. The question is, how fast does that happen? I think the other thing that you asked was what's changed about building Chainlink compared to the original white paper. I think when we launched the original white paper, oracles weren't really being used for much. And that's why things like DeFi didn't exist. And so when we launched the initial white paper, we were at like stage zero of startup land, which was trying to find some kind of product market fit. Any kind of product market fit for this Oracle problem. And so the difference there was that we had to find product market fit and then engage in what's known as a land grab, which is a common dynamic with new technologies that provide a huge amount of value. Where if you've invented something, you want to make sure that your technology continues to be the best and develop and provide the most value. So you basically have to get it to as many people as possible to get their feedback and prove it and so on, and also, you know, get them to put value back into the system so the system improves. So I think the biggest change is that we've clearly proved that, right? When you look at the most conservative metrics, Chainlink networks power over 65% of DeFi. The more specific metrics to specific parts of DeFi have a Chainlink powering over 80% of it. And so what you really see is that we've reached this level of being a standard. And now what we need to do is make sure that the standard meets everybody's requirements so it can remain the standard, while seeing what the standard can be expanded to do that it doesn't do yet, using the same security guarantees that made Chainlink the standard for securing data. And those security guarantees of Oracle networks can go very far beyond data. As you can see from some of the slides in my presentation, there's this one specific slide with a stack diagram, and it shows that Oracle networks are basically applicable to everything that needs to be trust minimized, but that will not be computed on a chain. And so that's a pretty big universe of things, because chains primarily compute private key signatures, token ledgers, and state machines. And so everything else, random numbers, market data, identity data, proof of reserves, functions, automation, cross-chain communications, and value transfer, all of those things can be secured with the same security that's already secured over $7 trillion for DeFi applications from a market data point of view. And so the question now is, how do you maintain your ability to be a standard and to make sure that that standard meets all the requirements of users, while also expanding what the system can do? And then I think the third thing is, how do you get all the users of the system to easily and efficiently pay into the system so that their payment into the system allows its network effects to increase and accelerate? So it's this question of, how do you maintain the quality and the standard position for data that you've gotten? How do you expand into other key categories that can be combined with data in very interesting ways? And then also, how do you make it so that the system is not only sustainable, but that its network effect continues to grow more and more rapidly, because the applications and the users utilizing the system are able to pay into it in a way that contributes to those network effects and contributes to increased security? So I would say that those are the new challenges versus the first challenge, where we just had to make anything work.
Yeah, makes sense. Jumping a little bit to the current year, you know, what would you say you're most excited about in terms of Chainlink in 2023?
I mean, it's March, right? So every single year since about 2011 or something, March, I'm still very hopeful that the whole industry will be booming, that all the banks will adopt this, that all the consumers will decide they need control over their financial life, that DeFi will boom, that gaming will transfer itself over to blockchains because that's a better ownership dynamic for people grinding thousands of hours into a game. So it's March. I'm very positive about everything about our industry. So what I'm always most excited about in March is that everything's going to boom, because obviously this makes sense. If you talk to me in November, December, who knows what I'll be thinking? I'll probably be thinking it's been a good year, didn't boom as much as I'd like, but there was a lot of incremental progress. We should be happy. Let's keep working. What I'm most excited about for Chainlink is really solving the three problems I just mentioned, right? So can we as a community build a better and better version of Chainlink's data product and data services and data side that allows derivatives and various other DeFi innovations to grow, become better and better, reach feature parity with external alternatives, centralized alternatives, and then surpass those alternatives. So the data side is important, and there's a lot of work there on low latency oracles. That's a lot of very exciting work that I think is going to be relevant to how the entire blockchain industry develops, and very much to how the DeFi industry develops. Then I'm excited about the expansion into what oracles allow in entirely new categories of developer activity. So really, I think the way to think about it, the framework in which you can think about it is, what is the depth of what's being built? And then what is the breadth of what's being built, right? So on the depth dimension, the data quality needs to continue to increase. And on the breadth dimension, how can we allow developers, Web3 developers, to build more advanced smart contracts by connecting them to more and more data, more and more systems, both through data feeds and through Chainlink functions? And then the other question is, how can we allow developers to build smart contracts that function across multiple chains at the same time? Similarly to how Web2 applications are built using multiple clouds at the same time. And so what you're really seeing is Chainlink starting to branch out beyond the extreme amount of depth and quality that it has in data delivery and successfully branching out into computations. And while that started with random numbers, it's now expanded very far beyond that, right? Automation is already live on production, powering many of the best, largest applications in our industry that care about securing their value properly. Functions recently got launched. That's very exciting because it really expands the breadth of what people can build themselves. And cross-chain communications, not just token transfer, but communications with CCIP, I think will be very exciting because it could create a world where there's multi-chain smart contracts, which is a world that we're slowly inching towards, but aren't there yet. And then I'm also excited about how do all these developments create an economic relationship with developers and their applications and the users of those applications in a way that feeds value back into the Chainlink system to allow it to become more secure and grow its network effects. And so this is the other thing I'm excited about moving forward with Chainlink Economics 2.0. In terms of the verticals, like I said at the beginning, I'm excited about DeFi, gaming, and traditional institutional banking. I've been excited about insurance for many, many years. And it's still moving forward, but the insurance industry is not the fastest moving industry in the world. So I'm still excited about insurance, but my top three right now are DeFi, gaming, and I put real world assets under DeFi, by the way. So real world assets are definitely in DeFi. Within DeFi, I think it's a mix of derivatives and real world assets. Those are the categories in DeFi that I'm currently the most excited about. Gaming, I think there's a lot of various categories, but I think there's going to be more and more games where if people decide to sit there and grind out a few thousand hours playing a game, they could actually pay rent doing that because what they get from the game has real value. That's a very like logical direction, in my opinion, because the gaming company doesn't just take all the value. The gaming company shares the value with the people grinding out thousands of hours, right? And you actually see this in some games like EVE Online and others where people can make some amount of money. WoW Gold's a good early example. Yeah, stuff like that.
Speaking of Chainlink services, what is Chainlink's approach to product roadmaps and product prioritization? Historically, these two things haven't been made fully public and oftentimes the language is pretty hedged. What is the reason for Chainlink not making hard commitments for future-facing features or public-facing roadmaps?
The reason that we're cautious about making commitments is because we take them seriously. And beyond taking them seriously, I think we're in an industry that's extremely volatile and extremely fast. Basically, I don't actually know of another industry that moves faster than the blockchain industry. In other industries, 1 year is like 1 to 3 months in this industry. And the difference is whether it's one of those months where something like FTX happens, or if it's one of those months where like a bunch of stuff happens over the course of 3 months. But I think this industry moves something like four times faster, maybe five times faster than other industries. And the key to success in that environment is flexibility and adaptability. And that's how we've actually been building Chainlink as a network together with the community. We've been building in a lot of optionality and a lot of choice. And you can even see that from the recent functions launch and how we're building a lot of other parts of the system together with developers from the user base and community developers and so on. You want to be able to adapt, right? You want to be able to have a part of the protocol that is very, very useful if gaming becomes very important. And then all of a sudden the protocol gets widely adopted for gaming purposes from something like VRF. And then you want to have another part of the protocol that's going to become really widely adopted if DeFi goes somewhere and there's a market data demand spike. And then there's another part of the protocol that's going to be very valuable if insurance becomes important. And the reason you want this in this environment is because you can't predict what the environment is, right? So I've been in this industry for many years. I can't predict it. I don't know what the next booming use case of blockchains is after very actively working on this stuff for over 10 years. And so after trying to predict what the industry is going to do next for 10 years, instead of saying, I'm such a genius, I'm going to predict it all, I've said, I can't predict it. It's a problem I can't seem to get my arms around. How do I manage that risk? And the answer to how to manage that risk is that whatever happens next, Chainlink should have an important role in it. That means if decentralized financial products become very important, Chainlink will land there and be very important. And then it will gradually expand to provide that industry with more things. And that's what we've seen with market data, right? Is we landed in that place with a lot of market data, but now there's a lot of DeFi that uses our automation and even random numbers, right? But the reason that they're using that is because they began the working relationship with the Chainlink system and the use of it because they immediately needed data because there was this spike. So the problem with giving commitments in an unpredictable world is that the world might change and the commitments you made might need to change. It's easier to give commitments in a world that's more stable and predictable and doesn't change every, like if our industry only really had things happen every year or two and our roadmap timeline for releases was 6 to 9 months, then we could do that. Like we could just, because we could predict it, right? We could know what's going to happen next. We could line it up with the roadmap and we could go. What's more important, I think, is this flexibility, this ability to adapt to a changing landscape. And what's helpful when you're dealing with a situation like that is an understanding that that's the situation you're in. So what would be helpful from the point of view of the community, anyone working with us, is to understand that our goal is to make a global standard for cryptographic truth, but to do it in a way that prioritizes the most important consensus and the most important cryptographic truth types. And that list of priorities can change because the market that uses that consensus and the market that uses that cryptographic truth changes very rapidly. And so it's not out of an unwillingness to provide people clarity. And I understand that people are very interested in the system, which I really appreciate. I'm super excited to be working on something where so many people are excited about it, because I've worked on things that no one's cared about. And this is much better. So I'm a big fan of having all these people interested in what I'm working on. But I'm not sure if I have the ability, or really anyone has the ability, to realistically predict for them what's going to happen in our industry. And if you're building technology that has to adapt to what happens in the industry, then you can't really be as predictive as you'd like about exactly what's next. You can definitely make directional bets, right? You can definitely say, we think that something like trusted hardware will become important, or we think that something like cross-chain will become important, or we think that market data of a certain type or identity data for regulated DeFi will become important. But if that market doesn't materialize at the speed that we think it, that we thought it would, then what we need to do is adapt. We don't need to sit there and continue to invest more and more engineering resources, community resources, and other resources in things that aren't going to succeed. We're much better off reorienting those limited resources towards the things that are going to succeed now, which is really, once again, what we're trying to do, right? And what's important, once again, is that I think that folks need to understand that part of what we're doing here. We're not just saying the world is only going to work in X way, and there's no way that that world could change. So we're committing to Y, and that's it. That's just not how the world works in our industry, and it won't set up the system to have the features that'll be the most in demand at any one time. The better approach is to make a flexible system that no matter what happens in our industry, we would be able to adapt quickly and be involved quickly and add value quickly because of the speed of the industry. And so what I think everyone should just maybe keep in mind is that while we're doing our best, we should be adaptable. And that's what's really gonna make this thing succeed, is that like when AI becomes important, there's a part of our system that can contribute to the AI industry. When NFTs becomes important, there's a part of our system that contributes to the NFT industry. When DeFi comes back and starts booming, we're in a very good position for that. But that doesn't mean that in the meantime, while those things aren't happening, that either something is wrong or that there's some kind of mistake. It just means that we're in a position where we have to adapt.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of touching again on the products, you know, I think sometimes people, you know, who aren't in the, you know, developers or whatnot, don't always understand, you know, what goes into a product. And so I'm just curious, you know, like what goes into like shipping a product? Like what are a lot of things that have to happen behind the scenes with testing and security and this and that, that people don't always see, but that, you know, lengthen timelines for shipping products?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think this is something I didn't understand either until I started building more and more advanced systems. And it goes to my earlier point at the beginning of our talk here, that I'm always so surprised why people don't adopt things quicker and why something isn't done quicker. And so I understand to a certain degree where this idea comes from. I think the simple reality is that what Chainlink is doing is inventing an entirely new way of doing things. And that actually has much more complexity and much more problems to solve than systems that are derivative and that copy things. So there are many systems that get built in a way where you basically combine other people's work. You make some modifications to it, and then you layer on interfaces for people to utilize that work. That can actually be accomplished quicker, because a lot of the backend problems and the computer science problems and the security problems and the game theory problems have been solved by pieces of infrastructure that you connect together to make the application that you want. Or to even make a new infrastructure. This is also the case for some infrastructures, because some infrastructures are, you know, sometimes just a copy of someone else's infrastructure where that person has solved the problems, and then this person copies it and changes some things, and so there they have something. So I think one big part of the problem is that Chainlink has originated an entirely novel form of consensus, which is commonly known as Oracle networks. There might be a better name for it, but it's this very general purpose form of decentralized consensus that can generate reliable security and consensus around many, many topics beyond blockchains, right? So blockchains generate consensus about private keys, token ledgers, and state machines. And that's great. And that's extremely valuable and important. Oracle networks can generate consensus about everything else. And that's why there's this very wide array of things that Oracle networks can be used for, from market data to identity data, to automation, to random numbers, to cross-chain, to functions, to a lot of things. But the reality of it is that we had to invent that. We as a group of people and as a community are inventing something. We are making something completely new, completely, right? We are basically doing something like taking the idea of filament and the idea of a vacuum and making some of the first light bulbs that last more than 10 minutes, more than 20 minutes, right? So inventing something like that, rather than using other building blocks that you didn't invent, or even making an application where you combine other people's infrastructure, has a lot of unforeseen challenges. Because once again, you're inventing something. Invention is not always the fastest process, right? We're very lucky to have a great research organization, which is at the core of Chainlink Labs. And we have a lot of great researchers from the community working with us, some of the best in the world, definitely some of the best in our industry. And, you know, we work with them on a regular daily basis to solve that problem. So I think that's one of the first big caveats. The second caveat is that we're inventing something that very, very highly prioritizes security and reliability. And that's also something that makes sense, because when you look at the history of various systems that secure large amounts of value, when you look at Amazon Web Services first offering like S3, or you look at the Swift interbank payment system, or you look at other places, if you look at their history, what you'll find is that their first priority, all of them, was security and reliability. Whether that was about storing images in S3, or whether that was about transacting between banks, or whether that was about something else. Infrastructures that provide security while also allowing people to build new things, to do new things, are the infrastructures that tend to win. Because people that run applications, make applications, have a responsibility to their users to keep things secure and reliable. And so they don't want to choose infrastructure that would lead things to be unreliable and insecure. That's a priority they always have. And in our industry, where there's a regular dynamic around hacking and theft by various adversaries, security and reliability are absolutely at the top of the list for people that are going to adopt any infrastructure, whether that's a blockchain or an Oracle network or a wallet or anything. So security is just, you know, almost table stakes. And creating real security and real reliability is not as simple as even making one version of a system. You actually have to make multiple versions of a system that all support each other. So you basically have to make the system, then you have to put like a safety net under the system, then you need to put another safety net under the safety net, and that's what you need to do. So while it might seem like, okay, I made one thing, and it works, and that's good. Okay, it might work today, but you're not building it to just work today. You're building it to work when gas congestion increases 100 or 1,000 times. You're building it for the day when an adversary comes and tries to use some kind of flash loan to manipulate a data source, right? You're not building it just for today when everything is smooth, when the waters are smooth and there's no wind and there's no waves. You're building it to withstand massive, massive waves, massive, massive volatility. And so that's another big nuance where we, in our work on Chainlink and the community's work on Chainlink, have, in my opinion, if you really look at it, succeeded. Because if you look at how the Chainlink system has managed congestion, if you look at the biggest periods of congestion on the most popular chains, the most recent ones, even when gas went to something like 2,500, Chainlink Oracle networks continued to broadcast while many, many other infrastructures and systems stopped working. If you look at security, Our security track record is by far the best of anybody in what we do. And realistically, this is why over $7 trillion in transactional value has been enabled by the system. So it's very clear that security has a lot of value. One way to think about it, you know, that I sometimes think about is you're really kind of trying to build something like the Star Trek Enterprise. And I'm a fan of Star Trek. And if you really watch the show, you'll see that on the Star Trek Enterprise, they don't just ever have one system. They have a backup, and they have a backup to the backup. And the reason that they get through a lot of hairy situations is because they have the backup, and then they have the backup to the backup. So basically what I'm telling you is that this isn't about just building one thing and getting it out and kind of saying, oh, if it doesn't work, no big deal. It's actually about gradually testing it, auditing it, running it on testnet, running it on a staging system, then running it on production in a limited way, then seeing how it holds up to things, then improving it if it needs to be improved before it goes to mainnet. Because this system is like life support on the Star Trek Enterprise, okay? It's a mission critical system. It's an important critical system. And so while I understand the desire to move faster and ship certain things, I personally believe that the ability to provide real security and real reliability that doesn't fail applications and that doesn't fail our industry in the times when things get hairy, that is what we should strive to do. And if we don't compromise on that, and if we're able to do that while still shipping the services that people want, then as the value that they secure continues to increase, their desire for security will eventually lead them to the system that provides them that security and reliability. So that even if they were to start using some homemade version of what we do or some version of what we do with limited guarantees or no backups or no safety net or nothing, then as the value increases, they always naturally revisit their risk. And the conclusion we want everyone to come to is the best way to manage my risk is to go with this Chainlink service that has all of these security guarantees and reliability guarantees. And obviously they should research that and they should understand that, and they will, and they have. And this is why we've secured over $7 trillion in transactional value. And this is why we have over 65% market share in DeFi based on the most conservative estimates. It's not because we just shipped something and hoped for the best. It's because we did a thorough, rigorous process to review things. We made it clear how the system works from a security point of view, and people that valued security adopted the system. Now, I definitely want to make sure that people understand why we're doing things, which is one of the reasons I'm here on this podcast. And I definitely want to make sure that everyone understands the value of the security that we've made once something goes out there and gets released. But I also very strongly believe that if we don't generate this security in a reliable, consistent manner, that not only will the system not get as adopted as it could be, but it'll actually slow our industry down. And once again, my goal in working on this, in addition to building something that's great like Chainlink, is to actually accelerate our industry, to make it so that the industry has infrastructure to build reliable, secure, transparent, high quality applications, because the infrastructure that they use won't fail. And obviously everyone's responsible for doing their own research and understanding the security dynamics of the infrastructure they put in their application. But we should strive to make the best infrastructure we can. And I guess basically what I'm saying, that it's more about quality than it is about quantity and speed. Because as the value secured in these applications grows, the quality will continue to become increasingly important to everyone.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to maybe add, or you could touch on too, is, you know, I spoke with some developers, and one thing I didn't understand, to be honest, until not that long ago is, you know, so you build the system, but, you know, auditing in this industry is also a big challenge because you're in a novel industry. There's very few people who actually know, you know, how to audit smart contracts. And so you might have to do multiple audits on a system, and especially with a more of a generalized functionality system that has a lot of different types of use cases, you got to test a lot of different types of use cases. So like there's a lot of variables beyond like what seems simple on the surface.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's nothing to say of the complexity, right? So there's the complexity of inventing a new system. Then there's the complexity of your new system interacting with other new systems that don't know how they work yet and are still figuring out their security dynamics around things like reorgs and a bunch of other problems. And then there's the problem of providing basic security and reliability for this combination of a new system with another new system. So the levels of complexity here are extremely high because we're actually not even using Chainlink to connect to very well maintained and very well managed and very, very well known systems, right? We're actually building Chainlink to solve entirely new problems that have never been solved and to solve those problems within and for other systems that only came into existence a few months to a few years ago. And so those systems don't always function the way they are expected to function. And then on top of that, you have to create the type of reliability and security that developers expect from infrastructure. So it's actually these three levels of complexity, right? Inventing something new, connecting it and making it work reliably with other things that are new, so that when those things don't operate as expected, like when the gas jumps 1,000x, your system continues to operate, right? That's a nice new wrinkle. And then in addition to that, you have to build all the safety nets, all the backups, all the things that can make the system continue to be secure.
Yeah, I want to step a little bit into Chainlink Economics 2.0, which has been a large initiative over the past year to support the network's crypto economic sustainability. Can you describe an overview of the economic model that's currently being built for the Chainlink network?
Sure. So what's happened with the Chainlink network so far is commonly what happens with many great technology platforms throughout history, is they provide the highest quality service in an efficient way that's easy to use at an attractive cost. And what hasn't been happening with the Chainlink service is that it hasn't been optimizing around getting folks to pay for the value of the security and the reliability that it creates. And to pay for that in a way that the more that they pay, the more security they get, which is something they also want. So giving them a path to gain more security as they pay more, because once again, as they secure more value, they're going to want more security and they're going to want to purchase more security. And so how do we make Chainlink not only a system that generates this kind of base initial level of security, but how do we make it something that generates increases in security based on people paying more into the system so that they can purchase more security for themselves? And that purchase can actually benefit both them and the system as a whole, which means benefiting all the other users of the system, creating a kind of network effect. So the overarching goal of Economics 2.0 is to solve this problem, right? Is how do the developers and the applications using the system put value into the system to purchase greater amounts of security? And how does that purchase of greater security by them, benefit the system, and benefit all the other users utilizing the system? Creating a larger and larger network effect as more and more applications pay more and more into the system to gain more and more security, because they need more and more security to secure more and more value. So this is kind of, I would say, the overarching goal. Now, it's a gradual process because we need to work out a lot of the game theoretic dynamics around a lot of the dynamics about what is the most efficient way for applications and their users to pay for Chainlink services of various types. The goal there is to make that as efficient as possible, is to make it that if you want to pay for the service, you can do it easily. And then the service converts all of that value into what it needs to convert it into to make itself more secure, to pay the various contributors and participants in the service like nodes and others and stakers? And how does it do that without bothering the user with that problem, right? So that's an example of a problem that needs to be solved. How do you make it easier and easier for everyone to pay into the system so that they can pay more, so that you can eliminate what's called friction, and so that those payments can go into the system to feed this additional security and network effect? There's already a lot of progress about incremental programs that are doing this in very specific ways. The Build program is a great example of this. The Scale program is another great example. The early V0.1 beta version of staking is another example. And some of the things around monetization and reducing costs are other examples. So all of those are very specific efforts to find the right methods for getting value into the system, getting costs to be reduced so that security and network effects increase. So that's kind of where it is now. I think it's in the early to mid stages, and it's something we should do gradually, because we definitely want everyone to continue to use Chainlink as the standard, but we also want them to have this path where if they want, they can purchase greater security. And then the purchase that they make ideally benefits the system to the maximum degree possible. And therefore everyone benefits, right? The developer of the application benefits because they purchase more security. The system and its participants benefit. The industry benefits because now there's a more secure way to build applications, and therefore people are more comfortable putting greater amounts of value into those applications, which is good for the entire blockchain industry. And so that's really the goal that we hope to see with Chainlink Economics 2.0, and to have that happen in a gradually cautious but thoughtful way.
And kind of piggybacking off that question a little bit, you know, why do Oracle protocols like Chainlink need a token? And also, like, what are the role of Oracle awards in an Oracle network?
So there's this notion of crypto economics and crypto economic security that I don't think is still a super widely understood idea or a super widely understood field of study. And in many ways, when you talk to people about this question, even for existing systems like Bitcoin or Ethereum or others, you find that they don't fully see the economic and the game theory dynamics that are at play to allow the system to continue to operate properly, right? So I think anyone interested in this question should look into crypto economics and to ideas around crypto economic security. And there's a number of points I've made in some presentations, even with diagrams about this. And there's a number of points in our white paper, the 2.0 white paper. And I think that's the place where people should really understand this. And it's kind of like understanding certain macroeconomic or microeconomic or game theory concepts, right? So until you have the concept, it's tough to fully grasp what's going on. Like, you know, ideas about marginal unit economics and stuff like that. So the first thing I would say is I would look at crypto economics generally, and I would look at ideas around crypto economic security and how crypto economic security and incentives allow decentralized infrastructure to continue to operate properly. It's pretty clear that the incentives that our system has created by paying Link to Chainlink node operators has allowed it to resist adversaries and has allowed it to resist massive congestion on various chains where other systems were not able to continue operating. So the thing that I would point to is you need an understanding of crypto economics. And the real proof point is whether or not a system stands up to adversarial conditions. And Chainlink has stood up to situations where node operators have had to pay many more millions of dollars than they expected to operate, but they continued to operate. And so the crypto economic model we have clearly works based on that simple proof. In terms of what the token is used for, there's a number of utility use cases that are there some of which are common to tokens and some of which are unique, because Oracle networks once again solve a unique problem that blockchains and other systems don't solve. Now, the token is used to pay for the services. It's used to incentivize the node operators to run the system properly. And now it's going to be used for staking so that more and more community members can participate in the system to secure it and receive a portion of the value that the system creates. So I think that the basic way to view the token is that for certain cases, it's a payment mechanism. For other cases, it's an incentive mechanism to make sure that the system remains secure and that the nodes continue to operate properly. And beyond that, it's also a staking mechanism to allow a larger and larger group of participants to create more and more security. The thing that I think that's also clear is that as more and more Chainlink services get adopted, more and more stake will be required and more fees will be paid into those Chainlink services because they will secure more and more value, more and more applications. And to some of the earlier points about how someone could buy security, one of the very simple ways for them to buy security is to agree to pay more into services and networks and specific nodes that provide larger security guarantees by providing larger amounts of stake. And so if you arrive at a world where nodes all have very similar security guarantees, one of the ways that they can differentiate themselves to get a larger and larger share of the fees is by creating a larger and larger set of tokens, set of link tokens that they put up to stake to secure those promises. Now, for all of that to come into existence, you obviously need a lot of things to come together. You need the staking system to support that functionality. You also need there to be enough revenue to the node operators to justify them staking all those larger and larger amounts. And so it's not an overnight process because you need both of those things to happen. And frankly, if one of them happens, but the other one isn't ready or the other one doesn't exist, then it's not as critical that the other one happened, frankly. So what you really want to do, I think, is build a system that very efficiently, with limited friction, can gain as much value from the users as possible, where they want to pay that value because they're gaining more and more security. What they pay into the system is distributed in a way that benefits the system and allows it to be more secure and reliable. And then you want mechanisms where one of the ways to increase that security is the stake you put up. But putting up that stake to gain more security for the system and for the user of the system is only valuable or only really going to happen when there's enough revenue from users and from developers of applications to justify putting up more stake. And so those two things need to evolve in tandem, and the dynamics around them aren't completely within our control because they're once again related to the growth of the industry and the speed at which the industry grows and the speed at which users come and use applications, which once again is another reason why it actually makes sense that it would be great if the industry accelerated as a whole, because if Chainlink networks power over 65% of that, then the acceleration of the industry as a whole would invariably lead to anywhere from 65 plus, anywhere from 50% to 80% plus going into the Chainlink network for the applications that it services. And so it's all pretty connected, right? It's kind of like you have these initial use cases for the token that are going well, they're clearly working, they're clearly providing crypto economic security because the system operates successfully through various adversarial difficult conditions that other systems don't operate through. Now you have more and more advanced ways to use the token and eventually arrive to a world where people can essentially purchase more security in an efficient, frictionless way. And a part of that security is provided by staking the token, because that can be a differentiating factor for your reliability as a node or as a network or as a participant in the system. And this will, I think, over time, become more and more important as people want to purchase more security, right? But the caveats there are, there need to be more people paying more fees into more applications that secure more value so that people want to purchase more security, right? So that's the dynamic that invariably has to happen from any version of that more advanced view of the token and of staking to occur. And that's a dynamic that'll happen gradually as the industry grows and gains more adoption, in my opinion. It could take longer, it could come quicker, but it isn't going to happen overnight.
I want to touch on the crypto economic security point a little bit and how that relates to the token. I think people generally don't always understand this incentive model. And I think you gave a good example a little while back by comparing it to BTC and the Bitcoin network. Essentially, when you have a decentralized network of service providers, you want to ensure that they have financial skin in the game that is connected to the health of the network. With the Bitcoin blockchain, miners have exposure to ASIC mining equipment, whose only purpose is to mine BTC, and exposure to BTC via being the rewards that they mine and what they hold. So if miners attack the network, then the value of that BTC would be harmed as a result, given that BTC has value because the network is secure. So if that happens, then a miner's future income is affected, as the BTC they mine is worth less, and any BTC they hold is worth less, and the ASICs they mine with is also worth less, since ASICs are essentially future Bitcoin. So the result is miners are financially incentivized to maintain network security for their own bottom line. We kind of see a similar dynamic in the Ethereum network with validators having skin in the game through their staked ETH and the ETH they generate through the work securing the network. These are the same type of incentive models that are employed in the Chainlink network today, where Oracle nodes have financial exposure to Link, both in terms of the Link that they earn from performing work on the network and the growing amount of staked Link that they'll require as the network expands. If the Oracles attack the network, then they not only harm the value of their Link income and their holdings, but users would be far less willing to pay fees into the system, just as the same as blockchains. I think this is a pretty powerful dynamic of crypto economic security driven by a token. But I want to step into the community related questions a little bit. I'm curious on your general thoughts on Chainlink's unique community and the positive impact that they can have on the network, its adoption, and its overall place in the Web3 space.
You know, I'm actually very grateful to be working on something that not only secures so much value and not only can change the world in this way that I find personally important, but that has so many people that share that excitement with me and that want to see the world changed in this way and then kind of share that worldview. And that's something, you know, pretty unique and new to me. And it's also not something that a lot of other technology systems or products or protocols or things have. And I think it's because we invented something pretty original with Oracle Networks. And there's very clear proof that not only did we invent something original, but it actually resulted in creating something like the DeFi industry, which did go on to make a dent in how our industry is viewed and used. And so people have kind of tasted the reality of what we create being important and that being a part of that is a great thing. So I'm super grateful. I'm kind of like taken aback sometimes by the amount of excitement and positivity that people have about this. And it's really a great thing. It's not something that I'm super used to, and it's not something that I have a lot of experience interacting with. And it's not something that I spend a lot of time thinking about how to interact with correctly or in the best possible way, because I don't really view my role as much as a cheerleader. You know, I don't do a presentation every month. I don't go to every single conference I can go to and talk about this stuff. I kind of view what I and a few other key people in our community need to do is really deliver on these on this vision and on these ideas. In many ways, I feel we've already delivered on the vision of the 1.0 paper, but now there's this larger vision, and I'm really much more focused on delivering on that. Once again, while adapting to how the world changes. What I think the community does is actually a lot of things. It provides a lot of social proof and positivity around what we're doing. which I think is attractive to a lot of folks in our industry, and which I think allows folks to learn about our system. So I think it's good that there are cheerleaders of this worldview of a world powered by cryptographic truth that can clarify for people that don't know what that is, firstly, what that is, and secondly, why Chainlink has an important role to play in that. So that more and more people can be informed about that, and so that some of those people can either help build the project, maybe they can implement the project. Like, I know that many of the developers that build applications are big Chainlink fans themselves, because they believe in the cryptographically guaranteed world that we feel we're going towards. And so the non-technical community, and I think there's just this important distinction of technical versus non-technical. The non-technical community, I think, has this very important role to play of informing the world about what's going on and informing them in a way that aligns more and more people to creating a world powered by truth and to the notion of cryptographic truth and to the value of everything I said at the beginning of this talk, where the world can work in a different and better way. Now, I think what that requires is basically excitement and positivity about these ideas in a way that makes them attractive to new folks coming into our industry. And this is something that some of the communities that I've seen previously in our industry for the many years I've been here have had. Sometimes there's lulls in that when there are difficulties, like when things don't move as fast. And sometimes those lulls are overcome by those communities, and sometimes they aren't. Now, I think that the non-technical community can act as this very important resource to inform a large amount of decision makers, a large amount of developers, a large amount of future community members about what we're doing here. If they do that in a consistently positive, consistently constructive, consistently forward-looking, future focused, like, you know, it's going to take time, but we're going to fix the world in this way. It's not an easy problem to solve, but we're here to solve it, and it's worth solving for all these reasons. Like, all of these positive dynamics, I think over time they can accrue a large community of people who are both technical and non-technical that believe in this and continue to support it in various ways. So I think the non-technical community has this very important role to play in making sure that the system is well known, the system is understood, why people joining our industry should join our community, why they should build on our system, why security is important, why cryptographic truth is important. These are new ideas that people don't understand, that aren't fully appreciated, that our community has a very deep grasp of, and that if we find a productive, constructive, positive way to share with the millions of people that are going to be joining our industry in the coming years, then our industry can benefit, and our community can become one of the largest, if not the largest, community in the whole industry, which would obviously be a very large advantage. The other very positive effect of this is that having a larger and larger non-technical community does lead to a larger and larger technical community. And having a larger and larger technical community allows more feedback on the technical architecture, allows more feedback on how the system should perform, allows more developers contributing commits, contributing feedback, allows more hackathon participants building new advanced use cases, and frankly, just allows more and more useful technical conversations that can contribute to the improvement of the system. So I think that the community has done a great job in certain periods of time when we've been moving very quickly, things have been going very well, everything has been positive. But as you'll read from any startup-related literature, any early-stage technology literature of any kind, you'll come to see that startups are not stable in their rate of success on things. It is what's known as a roller coaster. And that roller coaster has ups and downs and ups and downs. And in my experience, the key in making early stage technology things and products and systems successful is to remain focused and to work on the things that you can do, which provide the greatest amount of value, that provide the greatest amount of progress, that provide the greatest amount of positive input into the system. And so that's how I advise people to think about it, right? I think we have a great, unique community. I think there's a lot of really thoughtful people there. I think they have very nuanced and thoughtful ways of explaining what this is about. I think the memes and other things are very creative, attractive, viral in nature, ways of explaining these key important ideas. And I think that the community can also act as an important defense mechanism if misinformation is spread about our system, which has played an important role in keeping people clear on the value of the security and the value of what the system does, which I also appreciate. But I would say that just like anyone that I would talk to about contributing to a system or creating a valuable input into a system, I would say that focusing on the activities that provide the greatest amount of value that you're most capable of doing is the more general way to think about it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to continue to try and build a secure, reliable, high quality system to the degree that I can. I'm going to try to be clear with people on the risks of the system so they can make informed decisions and so they can get to a point where they can eventually just buy more and more security. And I'm going to try to provide clarity to the community the way that I am now in this podcast and in future conversations, to the degree that I have that clarity and I fully understand what's going to happen next and I can actually commit to something. But realistically, building something completely new in a highly volatile industry that goes up and down, that moves at 4 to 5 times the speed of other technology industries that already move extremely quickly, is going to be a bumpy up and down a journey. And on bumpy up and down journeys, you know, whether that's a long hike through the woods or whether that's building a technology together, there are basically people that add value, help share the load, help carry the water, help make everything work, help be a positive motivating force for everyone else. And then there are folks that do the opposite. When I go on hikes, when I walk in the woods, I'm always positive because I know it's going to be a long hike. I know it's going to be a matter of days. And realistically, there's going to be ups and downs during that hike, and there's going to be ups and downs doing whatever you do in life. And so my view is that the community has a huge amount to contribute to the success of this. They've contributed hugely to its success already. And if they want it to succeed, I think they should find the things that they're uniquely great at doing, the inputs that they're uniquely great at providing, and to focus on providing those inputs, avoiding distractions and avoiding things that are not those inputs. And that's just generally how I think people should work on things. So that's my view.
Yeah, so just one point, kind of, you talked a little bit about, you know, how the community can play a role. And at the and part of that answer, you also talked a little bit about, you know, how Chainlink plays a role in interacting with the community. Just curious how you've seen, you know, how Chainlink's communication with the community, how that's kind of evolved over time and where you see that now and maybe some different things that, you know, that's being rethought out, you know, that can improve that communication.
I think the realistic answer to this is twofold. The first part of the answer is I'm not fantastic at communicating with the community. I'm not spending all of my time on how to communicate with the community or how to make a YouTube video or how to tweet. You know, I try to spend the vast majority of the time on how to build a secure system, how to get other great people to work with me on Chainlink, how to get great researchers involved to contribute to the things we need to invent together with them. Those are the things that I tend to feel that I'm focused on and I'm adding the greatest amount of value and input into the system by. So I think the first part of this really is that I'm not very masterful at this. I'm not very thoughtful about this. I'm not very experienced in this. And that doesn't mean that it's not important. I think it is important. And I've done what I can to write some blog posts and to make relatively regular videos to provide the more important new ideas that come. And what I notice is that basically there's like this lull of information. And then there's this big video that I make of like an hour plus. And that's because, you know, I just set aside time and I make that video and I put out what I can put out. So I think the first thing is that I'm not sure this has been handled in the optimal way by me, because it's not something that I think I'm particularly great at. It's something I'm going to continue to try to be better at. But just so everyone understands, while I wasn't making YouTube videos and tweeting every single day five times about how exciting the future is going to be, I was actually working on the future, making a system together with many others that powered over 7 trillion in transactions. So that's what I was doing instead, which I decided was what people wanted me to do instead of giving them more tweets, because I feel that they already have many, many of those. Well, they don't have a really reliable, good Oracle network that powers DeFi, right? So that was the reasoning there. How I think it'll evolve going forward is that there are now more people that are better at this than me. We have various folks in the marketing org. There's more product folks working on improving Chainlink that are actively providing more updates. I think the answer to this is that there are more people that are working on more parts of the system, and they will also now be able to cautiously provide information, so that ideally this doesn't just depend on me. Because, you know, I have limitations on my bandwidth. I have limitations of how much time I have every week to address a community concern or provide new information. Because once again, I feel that the highest value input that I can make into the system is helping create the system in very specific ways. You know, helping design the system, helping get great researchers to work on the system with me and with us. Helping make sure that large users are getting the benefit they need from the system, and that the system is actually solving their security problems and soon enough their usability and payment problems and so on. So the real answer to this is that the community will now have more people to interface with. There will probably be more systems. I'm going to try to show up on more podcasts like this and other places. But I think the thing that would be very helpful is a certain degree of understanding from the community that I'm not just focused on making the community happy all the time, because the ups and downs of the industry we're in and the ups and downs of the complicated problems we need to solve make that a kind of unsolvable problem. Because there will always be something that makes people upset in this industry. And there will always be something that isn't happening fast enough. And if I really think about it and I ask myself, well, what do people actually want from me? Do they want me to spend all my time telling them things, or do they want me to spend my time making the things happen? I really just default to the second one, right? I still feel right now that while I will do what I can to provide clarity, do podcasts like this, be candid about my concerns, be candid about what's going to happen next, as far as I know, and you know, before something about the industry happens to change, I still feel that really what I should be doing is providing the value of helping build the system in the best way possible. So the real answer is, I think there's a lot of great people working with me on Chainlink. They're working on how to provide greater amounts of updates. They won't always have all the answers either. They will try to be clear to the degree that they can. The thing that'll help them be clear, frankly, is a certain level of calmness and understanding when the answers that people get aren't the ideal answers that they wanted. Because the more extreme the reactions to some kind of aspect or some of the system that didn't develop the way we wanted, or to some unexpected development, the more extreme those reactions are, the more fearful people become of creating clarity. It's like any relationship, right? If you go to a person and you tell them what's going on, and they completely flip out and they make it very painful for you, then you're less likely to share difficult things with them in the future. Now, I'm not saying that people have to be happy about everything all the time. I'm just stating like a simple fact that on the one hand, I'm going to continue to focus on making sure the system's built the way that it should be built, together with many other great developers, community participants, and others. I think everyone in the community that's non-technical should do what they're great at. Everyone in the technical side should do what they're great at. And we should all just remember that we are on a difficult, perilous, long journey that will have ups and downs. And that's what this is about. That's what this is. That's what it takes to make something new. That's what it takes to invent something that didn't exist before, that's in an industry that didn't exist even recently, and that's in a constantly changing environment. That's just how it is. That's just what it is to be in this industry. So I think if everyone understands that, and everyone can focus on what they're good at, and everyone can help support each other through difficult periods when there's ups and downs, I think that everything will work out fine. And that's how it's been largely going so far. And the more it goes in that direction, I personally think the faster we'll get to where we want to go, which is what I think at the end of the day is what we all want.
Thanks, Sergey. Appreciate you giving your thoughts on the community here. I agree that building the future, it's going to be a long and volatile journey. There's going to be unknown unknowns and unexpected challenges to overcome. I think the new approach to marketing, and I think you coming on this podcast, should provide a good amount of insight to people on how Chainlink operates. One last question that I want to touch upon. I know that you mentioned you can't predict the future, but if you had to extrapolate, where do you see Chainlink and crypto being in a 10-year timeline?
With the caveat that I'm always very positive on this stuff, as I said at the beginning, and I think every year is the year. It's this year. This is the year when blockchains are going to get adopted by banks and DeFi is going to explode. And I have this common optimism, right? I'm not as optimistic about other things, but I'm very optimistic about our industry. 10 years is a very long time horizon. So if you let my imagination run away with me on a 10-year time horizon, and I'll just caveat it by saying this could be 10 or 20 years. I don't know. But the ideal state, I guess, I would say, is that everything in the world's powered by cryptographic guarantees. Everything from your real estate ownership to your coffee purchase, to your bank account, to your trip somewhere. Everything is backed by cryptographic proofs generated within blockchains and Oracle networks, because that's the superior way to give you various guarantees. If something goes wrong, those proofs and those cryptographic guarantees enforce those contracts in your favor as a consumer. You actually have control over your assets. That control doesn't get ceded to others. And the private key management issues get solved, probably through some collection of hardware and software on mobile phones. You arrive at a place where the securities industry, the derivatives industry, equities, commodities, real estate, insurance are basically anywhere from 50 to 70% powered by blockchains. And in all of those interactions, oracles play multiple key roles in allowing those interactions to happen, in allowing them to be scalable, in enabling them to do valuable things. And so if you have one blockchain interaction, for that one blockchain interaction, you might have 10 or 20 Oracle network related computations, because the Oracle networks actually do a lot of the work that blockchains can't and don't want to do. I also don't think that everyone is as tribalistic about what blockchain they're a part of. I don't think that many consumers even know that something is powered by a blockchain, but it is. And I think that a very significant portion of the global market, global equities, commodities, derivatives, whatever other financial market, are very knowingly market it as being blockchain secured, because that's the superior form of those products. So in on the 10-year timeline, I think we arrive at a world where cryptographic guarantees basically power everything that you need to have trusted, which is, if you think about it, you really need to trust almost every part of your digital life. And if you didn't have to trust it, if you could just have cryptographic guarantees, you would always take those.
Thank you for coming onto the podcast, Sergey. I hope that this can serve as a useful resource for the community to get some insight into some of the many questions that have popped up over time around Chainlink and Chainlink Labs as an organization. To wrap things up, do you have any last points that you want to make to the community?
Yeah, I just want to once again say that I'm super, I'm really grateful to have so many people that are genuinely interested in what I'm working on and what's being built in the form of Chainlink. It's really great to have people that understand the value of the change in the world that we're going towards, and to have their support and to have their feedback and insight. And I definitely want to get to a place where everyone is getting what they want. But getting to that place is, I think, gonna require all of us to work very productively with each other. And what I'm gonna try to do is do the things that I think I'm uniquely good at, or the things that I can contribute the most value through. And what I hope the community can do is continue to work with us in the great productive way that they have been, which once again I'm immensely grateful for. And I'm always thrilled to see community members and to meet up and to have good conversations. So I guess in my closing words would be thank you.
Thanks again for coming on, Sergey, and thank you all for listening. Have a good one.